This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. During her lifetime, Leibbott spent much of the rest of her life working to protect and restore the Great Lakes. The pioneering environmentalist died last Saturday at the age of 91. Northwest Indiana video producer Nick Manta spoke with her at length back in 2009, and we begin this remembrance of her with her remarks to Nick.
The general public doesn't realize why this area is considered globally important from a scientific perspective. And that's because the geographic position means that we get a meeting of the climates from north, south, east, west, which means it's very unpredictable day to day, but it means that a lot of different plants have adapted to this area. And this is the only place where we have plants that, where this is the southern end of northern plants, the north end of southern plants, same east and west. I have prickly pear cactus growing under oak trees in my yard. This is the only place in the world where that happens. And that's understanding the connection between plants and how they adapt to the place where they live, and the articulation of that idea by a man named Henry Chandler Coles in 1898 is the reason that Northwest Indiana is, in science, considered the birthplace of ecology in North America. My name is Leibbott. I live in the Miller Beach section of Gary, Indiana, beside a wonderful natural intertidal pond. I am very active since I retired from full-time work with the Dunes Learning Center, which I helped to establish, with the Save the Dunes Council, with the Alliance for the Great Lakes, which I helped to organize as the Lake Michigan Federation back in 1970, and various other organizations. No, it wasn't called environmental awareness, but I remember someone, my grandfather probably, and he wouldn't consider himself an environmentalist. He had been a homesteader in northwest Oklahoma near the beginning of what used to be called the Great American Desert, the Great Plains. And he must have been the one that explained to me why he planted what were called shelter belts, which was a New Deal program to plant trees to try to reduce the dust storms. And I was about 4 years old, and I was riding in front of him, sitting in front of him on a horse, and we were riding out to a pasture to see how well the shelter belt out there was growing. And that's the first memory I have that fits with. And I think maybe that's why I think now I say to a lot of my environmental friends, I give up on you guys. I got to work on the kids. That's the really important thing. Starting in the 50s, the League of Women Voters made water pollution their primary focus for some years. They got the 1965 Federal Water Pollution Control Act passed in Chicago as part of my growing involvement. I didn't know it at the time, but growing involvement with these issues, I became involved with the public participation under that law, but it didn't work very well. And the concern about pollution was growing. Silent Spring had been published in the early 60s, and a lot of the situations that Rachel Carson described in Silent Spring were in the Midwest. I joined Save the Dunes Council in 1959. Many Chicago people had been involved in the effort to get a national park authorized by Congress in the dunes. In fact, the first idea for creating a national park came from the Chicago businessman named Stephen Mather, who was the first director of the National Park Service, appointed in 1916 when the National Park Service was established. And that practically the first thing he did was to propose what he called a sand dunes national park to stretch between Gary to Michigan City along the south shore of Lake Michigan. And in 1916, there was a big hearing by the U.S. Senate in Chicago where this idea of getting a Dunes National Park was a big civic issue. And the support was immense. It's a national park. It's not just an Indiana park. And I did join the Save the Dunes Council in a few years after it started in the late 1950s and was one of those people in Chicago that was very active with the effort to get the park, and became friends with Senator Paul Douglas, who was the Illinois politician who led the fight because no Indiana politician would do so, because it was the official policy reflected in many in laws and programs of the state of Indiana that the best use of the shoreline of Lake Michigan was industrialization, and the intention had been to industrialize the shoreline entirely. And I live in Indiana now because I loved the dunes. I raised my four children coming frequently to the dunes, staying in the dunes in the summer. We had the good luck to own second homes out here for periods of time when my kids were growing up. And I always wanted to sometime to live in the dunes. I didn't intend to become so involved. I thought I was retiring. My last full-time job, I was head of the City of Chicago's Environmental Agency under Mayor Washington. And I was devastated when he died because he had a vision. And I think one of the most fortunate things for me is that I've been able to work on these issues in several different ways. I was a volunteer, a citizen volunteer. Then I learned how to organize not-for-profit organizations, established the Lake Michigan Federation, went from there to work for EPA on behalf of the Great Lakes. Then I was appointed by President Carter as head of a 8-state regional planning agency that was supposed to coordinate federal and state policies. And I was in that job until James Watt became Secretary of Interior Ronald Reagan became president, and they abolished all these agencies, and I got fired by James Watt. And then I went to Northwestern as a research associate, working on Great Lakes policy issues for several years. And my, as I said before, my last job was working for the City of Chicago. So I worked from inside government and outside government, on the system, in the system. And I learned there are a lot of different ways to make things happen.
Liebot speaking with producer Nick Mantis back in 2009. The more recent interview she conducted was with John Cain for an Eye on the Arts segment on Lakeshore PBS, and that aired in January of 2016 as the work on the Shifting Sands documentary was wrapping up.
You really do have a movie project in the works, as they say in Hollywood.
Yes, I'm working with Pat Wisniewski, the producer of the Everglades of the North documentary, mm-hmm. and we're producing a documentary about the history of natural resources in this region and the importance of those resources to the rest of the world.
Your project is called Shifting Sands, is that correct?
Yes, to denote change. I was very frustrated about the lack of understanding of change that is underway in the region, especially by the people that live here.
Mm-hmm. And this documentary is going to premiere sometime around Earth Day.
Yes, that will be the formal premiere. We have been doing viewings of parts of the film with various groups throughout the region because I've always considered it a community project, not. And we wanted feedback from people. So we've had a lot of help from a lot of sources.
And how long have you been working on this project?
More than 2 years.
More than 2 years. And what have you, do you feel like you've learned a lot about movie making in that
Yes, I
time?
Certainly, I have learned about movie making, and Pat keeps telling me she's learning about the environment.
Yeah, you were saying that she's such a good environmental spokesperson.
Yes.
As a result of doing this. So who's actually who does all of the filmmaking for you?
Pat and Tom Desch is our editor. Mm-hmm. Ronna Siegel is done filming for us. And so we have a crew of people, but Pat is the lead person.
And does this chronicle the saving of the dunes movement?
Yes, it is both historical. Mm-hmm. And it is also informative about the changes that are underway now, mm-hmm. which is maybe even more important for people to understand. We are ambitious enough to think maybe we can change the reputation of Northwest Indiana.
So the work, you don't feel that the work is necessarily done, even though we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore this year?
No, but it was partly the fact of the converging anniversaries, the 200th anniversary mm-hmm. of the state of Indiana, the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, and the 50th anniversary of Congress actually authorizing our unique national park in this region.
Lee Bott speaking with John Cain on An Eye on the Arts production back in January of 2016. Lee lived in Miller until later in the year when she moved into an assisted living facility in Oak Park, and she died this past weekend of complications of dementia. Her daughter, Elizabeth Bott, said this to the Times of her mother: "She was always looking ahead. She was always forging ahead. She was always seeing opportunities and things to change. She was a great woman, and the world is better for her." State Representative Chris Young of Lake County has been holding public town hall meetings in his district about public education recently, and there are more coming up this week. And he talked with us about the topics that have been brought up by residents who are attending these public meetings at local library branches.
I've got two more town halls coming up. The next one is on Wednesday, October 9th at 6 p.m. to 7:30 at the Griffith Library, and that's with Michelle Reese, the superintendent of Griffith School. And then the last one is on October 10th, Thursday, at 6:30 to 7 p.m. And that's at the Dyer Sherrillville Library with Dr. Baracco of Lake Central. And so far, the meetings have been all right. They've been a little small, maybe around 15 to 20 people at each of them. But questions have been ranging from standardized testing about the requirements with iLearn. And there were a lot of stories a few weeks ago about how the new iLearn requirements are tripping up a lot of kids, and the pass rate dropped dramatically for the state, and what that's going to mean for next session. And also about my trip to Korea regarding the education tour that Representative Boehning, the chairman of House Education, what he and I did together. And we talked with the Ministry of Education, and we toured a high school. We went to a tutoring institution and talked with some child psychiatrists to see the comparison between Indiana and Korea, because both our students are actually very stressed by most measures and have suicidal tendencies. So we learned a whole lot, and we're looking to bring some priorities back over.
State Representative Chris Chung of Dyer, his final community meeting on public education programs is once again this coming Thursday evening, which is October 10th, and it'll be at the Dyer Sherrillville branch at the Lake County Public Library. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There is a facility here in Lake County that is Northwest Indiana's very first facility that offers what is referred to as fear-free practice. And to get that certification, folks at the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake had to go through a lot of training. Let's find out more about it by talking with Laura Redendaw of Hanover Veterinary Hospital. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, first, explain, if you will, please, what fear-free practice certification is all about, and then tell us what, in turn, you all, the veterinarians, as well as the other staff members, had to go through to be able to be qualified for this.
Sure. So fear-free medicine is a newer initiative in the veterinary industry that recognizes that the things that we do during exams and visits to the veterinary hospital can cause fear, anxiety, and stress in a pet. And we know these kinds of anxieties, they can lead to long-term health effects and anxiety disorders in dogs and cats. The initiative is a commitment to not only taking care of their physical well-being, but also the emotional well-being of the pet while they're with the practice. And not just here in the practice during their exam, but everything that leads up to the exam, the trip over, the trip home from the veterinary hospital. We just recognized that there was a better way to do this for pets. So the practice certification followed the staff being certified, and certification was available for team members in veterinary hospitals starting in March of 2016. Mm-hmm. This whole initiative was started by Dr. Marty Becker, one of the known kind of as the American's veterinarian. Practice certification was available starting in April of 2018, and we achieved our practice certification in October of 2018. In order to achieve this type of practice certification, you have to meet 27 mandatory standards and then receive 1,000 out of a possible 2,000 of 28 more standards. And this can be everything from pheromone therapy during exams to what color of paint is on our walls, that these aren't stress triggers for animals. So it was a process in achieving this certification. We are certainly proud to be the first certified practice in Northwest Indiana.
Well, take us with a dog and a cat through the process when we bring our family pet in to have an exam of some sort or some procedure of some sort at the end. What do you see in the lobby and as they get further along into the facility, get into the exam rooms?
That fear-free visit starts in the waiting room. We use pheromone therapy, and these are dog and cat appeasing pheromones used in diffusers and sprays that humans don't smell it, but it can bring the level of a dog's anxiety down. And then as they move through their exam, there are many portions of that exam that maybe you don't even notice that are going on behind the scenes, such as touch gradient and considerate approach of the animal, which means you don't just rush right up and in a really loud voice and talk to that animal right away, to gentle restraint techniques. You use the least amount of restraint to get done what you need to. We have pheromone therapy going in the exam rooms. And then one of the most, I think, obvious parts of a fear-free exam is going to be in the treat ladder. So the goal is to create a positive experience for the pet while they're here, because animals build on their experiences. So if we create negative experience after negative experience, each visit will escalate with a pet, and that's putting both the animal and the staff at risk in working with them. So we use treat ladders. You start with something that's sort of low reward, maybe like a crunchy dog biscuit, and then you move through things like semi-soft treats and everything up to whipped cream cups and ice cream. And, we get really creative in what kind of treats we bring in. This month is National Ice Cream Awareness Month or something along those lines, so we're doing ice cream with all of our appointments on Fridays for dogs.
That's interesting.
And cats. So that's the more obvious part of the exam. But keeping the noise level down, doing calming music throughout the hospital and through those visits for them, all of those things combined together can bring down, that stress for that animal while they're with us.
Okay. Let's go through the choice of pet. Let's say you bring a dog in. What special things do you intend to do as part of this procedure that will help make the experience not only better for the dog, but also for the pet owner and for the staff members?
For the pet owner, one of the barriers to bringing your animal to the veterinary hospital is that they're scared. You don't want to see your pet get a vaccine. You don't want to see them struggle during a nail trim. And it's traumatic to you as the pet owner because we love them so much and we don't want to see them in these highly anxious states. So if we can bring down the pet stress level, that will automatically carry over. It makes it more pleasant for the pet owner to bring it. They're not as anxious about bringing their pet to the vet hospital if they know that those pets are going to be treated like family. That every consideration is going to be taken to try to ease their fear of the vet visit. So that's on the client side of things, as well as communicating with them things that they can do to bring their pet in the least stressful way possible. And that might be through giving calming supplements at home or medications if that's what's needed, to playing some calming music on the way over, using pheromone therapy in their car, both on the trip over and the trip home, and that can start that visit off a little bit better.
How about for kitty cats?
For cats, it's a pheromone called Feel Away, and it works very well in cats. But bringing them in a carrier and then not having them wait in the waiting room where they might experience loud noises like dogs barking or phones ringing or things like this. Cats are very sensitive to noise. So our practice has a separate exam room that's kind of off of the main traffic of the hospital, and it is set up to, it's all about cats in there. We have not only pheromone, but we use textures that are pleasing to cats, like fluffy blankets and things like that. They have a litter box provided for them. They have a scratching post. We have cat nip, if that's what's needed for them, to bring that down, because cats in particular – not only can they be really dangerous when they're fearful, because they have usually more weapons than you have hands to control them during that visit, they tend to escalate quicker than mm-hmm. dogs do when you are stressing them.
Now, what seems to be the reaction, not only from the clients, the pets, and but for the pet owners as well, too, to all of these procedures that you are now introducing, basically, into Northwest Indiana in the fear-free practice?
Well, we've had some great feedback. It's reflected in our reviews and our testimonials from appointments where now people are talking about how calm their pet was during the appointment and how much they appreciated the extra time that we took to make sure their pet was comfortable with us and had a positive experience while they were here. We've had really good feedback. Our clients are really supportive. We're a well-established hospital in the area. This hospital's actually been in this area for 30 years, so mm-hmm. our client base has been able to move through this process with us. They've been with, you know, and yeah, great feedback from the clients. And the pets are, now that we're more than a year into it, we're starting to see repeated fear-free visits for pets, and we can tell the difference from prior to starting, you know, using some of these techniques to now where we can finally get, say, a nail trim done without, you know, three people to restrain. And we definitely see these animals coming in a lot happier and leaving a lot happier. Our goal is always to make the visit as pleasant as mm-hmm. possible, and we definitely are seeing pets react to that when they're having follow-up visits where they're not coming in as stressed.
Now, do you know if there are any other veterinary hospitals here in the region that are interested in this, to go through the certification process and to become certified as well?
I do think that this is something that probably a lot of veterinary hospitals are going to be going to. You know, I think that all of us in the veterinary industry, you know, are in it for the love of the animal. So anytime something comes up that gives us better tools to work with them and create these better experiences for them, I think everybody's probably going to get on board eventually. I know there are other veterinary hospitals in the area that have fear-free certified staff, but mm-hmm. so far as yet, we are the only practice certified hospital. So we'll see.
Laura, thank you very much for the info, and congratulations for everybody there at the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake of going through the process and being able to help make things better for not only the pets, the clients of your practice, but also for the owners of the pets as well, too. Thank you for the information.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Laura Redendaw is with the Hanover Veterinary Hospital in Cedar Lake. Welcome, Project Co-Directors Liz Werfel and Allison Schutte are working with $100,000 from the National Endowment for the Humanities Digital Projects for the Public Program to expand their project at the Valparaiso University. The project is called Flight Paths, Mapping Our Changing Neighborhoods, an interactive documentary. Allison was on Regionally Speaking to give us an update first of the project, the Welcome Project itself, and then more about the new initiative that is getting the federal support.
We began as a campus project, a story collection project on Valparaiso University's campus in 2009-2010. Liz Werfel, who is Associate Professor of Art and my co-director, she was really interested in starting to capture stories from students that she had worked with in China that were now matriculated over here to take classes, and noticing that there were moments when they felt included and moments when they felt excluded. And generally, the demographics of our student body was changing at the time. And as we began to think about what it would mean to collect stories, we realized that if it was an audio and video collection, documenting a range of student experience, a range of faculty and staff experience about these times when they felt like they belonged or these times they felt like they didn't belong, we could actually use those edited stories to help facilitate conversation about how do we live well together, especially amid increasing diversity. So that's how the project started, and I think it was by 2012 that we had our website up, which is just welcomeproject.valpo.edu, and we post regularly the stories that we edit there. Our practice is to do interviews that are about an hour and a half long, and then edit these 3 to 5 minute stories from them. And we quickly realized that student, faculty, staff experience was not limited to the boundaries of our campus. And we began to interview residents and think about ourselves as a larger regional collection. I would say that the Flight Paths Initiative, which we see as officially beginning in 2015, mm-hmm. so we're into our third, fourth year now, We were hearing from students that had grown up in Gary about reactions they were receiving from either students or town folk about when people found out they were from Gary, what the different reactions they were getting. At the same time as we started interviewing residents, we were starting to hear about people whose families had grown up in Gary but had left Gary. And we started to hear this larger story that was undergirding both of these experiences. And so when we started poking around, we realized there's a really rich history in the region that we could help document with oral history. So we began to think about what would it mean to interview residents of Northwest Indiana about growing up in Gary and their neighborhood life. If their families stayed, why did they stay? If they left, why did they leave? That larger picture, we realized we wanted to support in more than just an oral history way. So we began to work with our colleague in history, Heath Carter, who has done civil rights in Northwest Indiana, and really think about what is the larger historical story of Gary in Northwest Indiana that these oral histories point to. That includes the civil rights movement, it includes white flight, it includes businesses moving to the suburbs, it includes the automation of the steel mills, and that impact of disinvestment on Gary. And then for us, we're particularly interested in the region and like, how is this still impacting us today? And what kinds of conversations might we have as we revisit our past?
Well, you mentioned it here about the expansion just strictly from people who have lived and grown up in Gary into the areas. Now it's gone now into the, as you mentioned, the white flight issue. So you have residents who have basically moved out of Gary into communities like Merrillville and Highland and Griffith and Hammond, and even people who maybe have grown up in Hammond. They have some great stories to tell too, and the impact that all of the changes that have happened in Northwest Indiana have made on them as well. It's probably great conversations you picked up as well over the years, and this project in particular, the flight paths is going to bring up, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we have been encouraged to go west and make sure we collect stories in East Chicago and Hammond,
right,
which we have felt limited by our few persons that we are, two co-directors, numerous students, and most of our stories have reflected more on the Porter County side or like Gary, Merrillville area. So we have some work to do expanding to the west still for sure. And another gap that we have in the project is right now Flight Paths has been a black, white, and white ethnic story. But we're very aware that there's a Hispanic, Latinx history of the region too. And so one of the holes that we know we need to fill is to start collecting those stories as well. And I'm sure going into other cities west of Gary will also help with that.
And I imagine that this next phase, taking advantage of the project that you've applied for, maybe we should explain first, what does NEH stand for, and how did you all learn about the digital project that NEH has and the opportunity to apply for a grant that will in turn help you expand the Welcome Project?
So the National Endowment for the Humanities is a federal organization that looks to fund ways that the public can really engage with the humanities in a way that matters to their everyday lives. So we were encouraged to apply for NEH funding by our administrators when we asked them if we could get course release from teaching in order to help spend time on the Welcome Project. And the grants are one way that we can get some funding to buy some course release time. The digital projects for the public was actually a very generative grant. Like, we hadn't necessarily thought about Flight Paths as its own website, but the digital projects for the public is really aimed at creating these digital platforms. So what we are hoping we will have one day is an actual interactive documentary website that will center on a map of Gary and its neighborhoods, as well as the surrounding cities, And that will allow people to encounter the stories from our resident storytellers within historical information about important institutions like St. John's Lutheran Church or their school that they attended or their favorite ice cream shop.
Right.
And also to have a sense of how those individual experiences fit within the larger historical story. Things, practices and policies that were in place, federal policies oftentimes that, for example, subsidized the growth of the suburbs and really impacted cities like Gary. So we want these individual personal stories to be encountered in the larger region story. And we're really grateful for the National Endowments for the Humanities recognizing that Gary's story is actually a national story as well. So it'll be more for – it won't be only for regional residents. It will actually be for Americans generally who are interested in stories of deindustrialization.
That's interesting. When you found out through the NEH that the funds were available and you decided to put the application in to seek a grant, what was the process like? And probably the waiting period was excruciating. Knowing, as we mentioned, that there are a number of there are dozens and dozens, literally dozens of applications that are put in every year to be able to apply for the grant, and they only come down to, what, seven that they choose each year.
Yeah, I think that number changes each year. So yeah. I think this year they might have given money out to more than just seven. But the acceptance rate is pretty low. So the first grant we applied for was actually for the design document, and we didn't get it the first time.
No. Well, I guess you apply and you put in there hoping that you'll get something, and you come up short, but they just keep applying.
Get really good feedback, actually. So once we got the feedback from some of the gaps that we had missed, we went about filling those in, and when we applied again, then we got it on the second round. So the design document was actually the first NEH grant we got for $30,000, and we weren't sure we would get the production grant, which is the one we just got for $100,000. But we're really excited about that. Sorry, it's the prototyping grant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now we can move from the sketch board or mood board we created for what we hope the website looks like to actually creating substantial parts of it so we can give a proof of concept back to the National Endowment for the Humanities.
What kind of help did the folks from NEH give you as you were going through the process? You got a nice letter back when you found out about winning the $100,000 award that many people applied, but very few people had gotten chosen, and they particularly apparently liked what the Welcome Project was offering up this time.
Yeah, so I think in terms of support along the way, there's a program director for every grant. And so that's a person that you can call and talk to. You can send drafts of your application to so you can get some feedback before the actual deadline. So there is that one-on-one help that they give, and they have a sense of the process of what happens on the other end. There's a group of reviewers who are comparing these grants as they come in. For the design document, it was a lot of the historians and the humanities scholars. For the prototyping grant, it's the digital media team as well. So
right.
Now you have to have like a really sharp, keen awareness of who's going to build this for you, and not just the people who have the knowledge of the history.
Now that we get into 2019, you have the grant in hand, and you're able to move now into the, as you say, into the next phase, which is the work that's going to be happening on the prototype of the interactive website and the project itself. What's going to happen? What will folks see on welcomeproject.valpo.edu in the weeks and months ahead now?
Well, on the regular website, it will continue to be just the flight paths stories as they're edited.
Mm-hmm.
We will not have something for the public right away. I mean, the prototype, we're actually convening some focus groups, and the first focus group will happen this spring. And we are definitely interested in residents of Northwest Indiana, also professors, instructors at the schools, and some students to help us initially think about what draws people to these kinds of websites. So as we're creating the prototype over the summer, We'll have a sense of what our audience is drawn to, attracted to, looking for. And then by spring of 2020, we'll have some more focus groups that get some exposure to the actual prototype. But none of that will be public yet as we're working out the kinks and the bugs and things like that.
You'll have more people involved. And here again with the focus groups, you'll have a chance to find out more stories that you can get involved in, and then in turn will lead to more conversations that that you and the students that help out on the project will get to record, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're always open for more people to interview. So if anybody is listening today that wants to share their family story or their story about growing up in the region, we're definitely interested in that. We also often will facilitate community conversations around the stories we've created. So Liz Werfel got an Indiana Arts Commission grant about 2 years ago, and we created a 26-minute audio documentary from our resident storytellers that gives a really quick encapsulated history of the region. And we've used that chorus of voices, which you can actually also find on our regular website, to have county cross-county conversations about what happens when we hear and revisit this, the past and the stories of our families. How is that helping us think about where we're at today and who we'd like to be as neighbors today? So sometimes people encounter the stories not just through the website, but through these community conversations as well.
Well, it sounds like 2019 is going to be a very exciting year for the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, not only with the website itself, but also with all the projects that are going to be going on here as you continue on to this path that you've literally created, the flight paths, to be sure, as it's called, but certainly the overall path for the Welcome Project to add more conversations in, and in turn we'll be able to present here on Lakeshore Public Radio in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, we have a great partnership with Lakeshore Public Media, and we're really grateful for that. We've also really benefited from StoryCorps. They've been helpful on three occasions with helping us collect interviews in the region. So we're really grateful for our partners. And we couldn't, Liz and I certainly could not be doing this on our own. We have colleagues at Valparaiso University. We have colleagues at IUN. We have colleagues at IUPUI. We even have a graphic designer from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington on our team.
Wow.
So it's a really cooperative, collaborative endeavor. It wouldn't be possible without all of the students that have helped as well.
Well, it's a wonderful thing called the internet that is able to make the connections possible here. It's not only to be able to connect here in Northwest Indiana, but be able to reach out across the country. It sounds like to find the people out there that want to help out, make this project work even more. It's Welcome Project co-director Allison Schutte, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking.
Whistleblowing has dominated the news headlines for more than a week. Tom Mueller joins us to talk about the calculations that whistleblowers go through when they decide to raise an issue and about what is ahead for the person who called foul on the president. Mueller's new book is called Crisis of Conscience: Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud. That's next time on Think.
Tune in today at 2 o'clock here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Hi there, I'm Rachel Martin, one of the hosts of NPR's Morning Edition. I feel like a show has worked when we come off the air, and I'm getting feedback from people who say, it feels like you are a trusted friend. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
This school year, a dozen high school students in Elkhart County are testing out a new apprenticeship model that went from Colorado to New York City and now to Indiana. Student apprentices will work part-time at local companies and get paid. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, organizers are hoping the program will help connect students with companies that say they can't find enough skilled workers.
You ready to get your hands dirty?
Yeah, I told you this is what I wanted to do.
Here at Robert Weed Plywood in Bristol, it's high school junior Chris Camacho's first day on the job and his first day of school. He's getting a tour of the factory floor from his training supervisor, Natalie Hart.
You gotta come out here and actually do the work. It's not gonna be the funnest job you've ever had, no. You just gotta make it do what it do.
Camacho is here for a new 3-year apprenticeship organized by Horizon Education Alliance, or AGA. He and 11 others will spend the last 2 years of high school working part-time at a job site. Once they graduate, they'll work one more year full-time. The apprenticeship program is designed to help companies across Indiana that say they're struggling to find workers with the right skills and certifications. Here's Jason Harrison, HEA's Director of Pathways, speaking at the launch of the apprenticeship program.
This is the result of years of figuring out how we can work together, industry, education, and government, to launch a solution to our workforce challenges. And youth apprenticeships is one of the key solutions that we've identified.
The apprenticeship program is being modeled after Colorado nonprofit CareerWise. Community engagement manager Gabrielle Helfgott says their goal is to take an age-old idea and use it to solve a modern workforce problem.
And so that's part of what CareerWise Colorado set out to do, was to really bring to light that apprenticeships don't have to be these blue-collar positions. They can be more than that.
She advised HEA to start with just three career types and even told them not to expect every kid to stay with the program. Of the 12 apprentices in Indiana, many say they're testing this out to see if they really want to start college right after high school. But back in the break room at Robert Weed, Chris Camacho says he has no dreams of college. In fact, he says without the apprenticeship, he probably would have dropped out of high school. When his dad got injured about a year ago, he started working several jobs to help his family pay bills.
It's stressful. When you start working and you start paying bills, there's sometimes nothing left. And sometimes you're even lucky if you get a little bit left for yourself or for the groceries or something like that.
Because of the long work hours, he started failing classes. So he was surprised when he was picked for the apprenticeship program along with kids he recognized from the honors program. He actually felt kind of guilty.
I felt like I robbed someone's moment. I looked around like, dang, these are kids that are like going to college and all that. I'm just doing this to graduate. So to me, it was like, dang, I don't really belong here.
But one of his supervisors, Cindy Grider, is excited to have him as an apprentice, especially if the extra pay means he gets to finish high school. And while she recognizes that training teens like Camacho will probably present unique challenges, she says the benefits for students and businesses outweigh those.
I think in the end, we're going to come out with much stronger training programs to introduce all new employees to our environment. So there's lots of benefits for us.
At the launch, organizers announced a goal of eventually placing hundreds of apprentices at local companies. With ambitions that big, Indiana policymakers like Secretary for Career Connections and Talent Blair Milo are encouraging others around the state to take note.
And especially as we see the world of work changing as rapidly as it is, that having these closer connections between businesses and our schools is just going to be that much more critical.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
Barbara Brozier tells us about the members of an Indiana religious order who have traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border recently to help in the immigration process.
The Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ dedicate their lives to serving God and see helping the poor and powerless in their searches for justice as part of their mission. Sister Loretta Schlaper says she couldn't ignore what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border, where political decisions and morality can seem at odds.
And I wanted to see how we could make a difference for the people who were there in order to see what the issues really are.
Four of the sisters spent a few weeks volunteering in warehouses and shelters in El Paso, Texas, trying to provide some comfort to families who made the dangerous and exhausting journey to America. Sister Jolice May says the migrants they met all had the same motivation.
Their stories basically were, there's no future for us at home, and I'm doing it for my child. And that was the story, one after the other. This is for my child. There is no future. There is no education. There is no money.
One of Sister Edith Schneider's responsibility was accompanying families to bus stations, which was the beginning of another long journey for many of them. Sponsors buy the families tickets to different destinations in the U.S., where they will wait until their immigration court dates. She says many of the migrants traveled with no phones or money, just a small bag of belongings.
They are gentle, poor people escaping violence, mm-hmm. and what they have to endure. Who of us would endure, whether it's trekking through Mexico or that 3 or 4 day bus trip?
Federal data shows U.S. Border Patrols have apprehended nearly 125,000 families in the El Paso sector so far this fiscal year, a more than 1,500% increase from the same period in 2018. The sisters say they try to tune out the negativity and debates that surround the border, but Schlaper says they couldn't ignore what they saw.
A lady and her 19-year-old daughter coming through, and she said that they were like two gates away from freedom, you know, their chance to come in. When they said to her, and or actually said to her daughter, "What age are you?" And she honestly said, "I'm 19," where they snatched her away. And she was screaming, and the lady said she was screaming, because they said, "You are to be independent."
Sister Connie Bach says they did what they could to comfort families in those heartbreaking situations, but they knew in the back of their minds many of the migrants wouldn't be allowed to stay in the country long term.
It really is a crisis situation, and our country really should be looking at it just as much as, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes and all the things that affect our people. It's a life and death situation for a lot of people, and we've heard of the deaths already.
They're hopeful people will stop looking at the situation as a political one and see it for what they say it is, a humanitarian crisis. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Time once again for John Kane and Eye on the Arts, who's with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jason Utish. Did I say that
you
right?
You said it exactly
oh,
right.
Oh, good. And Jason is a board member of the Chicago Street Theater in Valparaiso. He is also the co-chair of the artistic committee there. And gosh, you all do a lot of shows in any given year.
We do a ton of shows. And then for our 65th season coming up, I think we've got, what, 8, 9 shows?
Wow.
Yeah, we've got a lot. We actually have 10 shows, including our Teen Fest. So we're busy.
So your committee is the committee that selects the season?
Yes, we select the season each year. It's a long process, and it takes – we're actually planning right now the 2020 and 2021 season.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long time in advance. It's a long process because not only are we reading scripts, we are also trying to line them up with directors and seeing how feasible it is to do this show. Is this something mm-hmm. that people are going to want to see, or is it just something that we would like to see? Is it something that is doable in the little space that we have?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not going to do Les Miserables because we have a small little 130-seat auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to choose the shows that our audience appreciates and that are very practical and in our space.
Mm-hmm. The Chicago Street Theater is the popular name of Community Theater Guild.
Yes, it's formerly Community Theater Guild.
So you've gotten rid of that altogether.
We are no longer Community Theater Guild.
Okay, I will erase it from my memory.
Yes, erase it. Get it out of your head.
Yeah.
That's still the corporate entity, but it's now doing business as Chicago Street Theater.
I see.
And Chicago Street Theater is the name that it will be moving forward.
And your theater group, one of many community theater groups in Northwest Indiana, but one of the higher level in terms of quality and management and governance. You've won awards in community theater competitions throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. And throughout the world. Several years ago, we had competed in a competition that took us into Europe. So,
wow.
Thanks for the kind words when that's our goal, is to offer high quality theater, but at a community theater price, if
mm-hmm.
you will. We like to pride ourselves on, for people who don't know, that we're all volunteers on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people will exit thinking that they're all professional actors.
Yeah. Well, that's just great.
Yeah.
And that reputation has been in place for quite some time now.
Yeah, absolutely. And for 65 years, this is our 65th season.
Yeah.
And every year we get a whole new group of patrons, new audience members that are seeing us for the first time, which we're always happy to see. And of course, definitely appreciative of the loyal audience members as well.
Your current show is Toxic Avenger.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, Toxic Avenger was originally a movie that came out in the 80s. Very cult-like, over-the-top, violence, gory, silly kind of thing. Again, it had a cult following. It had a sequel. It had a cartoon series. It had a couple sequels, actually. And this is that story, but this is also a musical.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially a story of a guy who's been bullied his whole life, doesn't get the respect that he thinks he deserves. He falls into a toxic pit and then decides to wreak havoc on New Jersey. All in good, though. He only goes after the bad guys, and then trying to win back the love of his life, who is a blind librarian.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing with this particular show is that it's a small cast. So you've got the Toxie is his character's name. Mm-hmm. You've got his girlfriend or his betrothed, and then you've got the other three actors, only three other actors, and they play multiple characters. Mm-hmm. Different genders, different types, different ages. And so it'll be a real treat for the audience to see not only the main two characters, but also all the remaining three actors come on and off stage playing different characters, different costumes, and hopefully trying to guess, now, wait a minute, was that person doing that, or are they doing this? So it'll be a fun time for everybody.
So this show runs through the 26th of October.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then what's after that?
So, actually, if we could stick on Toxic Avenger just for a second, we also are bringing in Svengoolie. He will be coming in, I think it's October 12th, and so he'll come in. We have a big party, food, drink, and he'll sign autographs, take pictures, and all that sort of thing, too. So it's been an annual event. Always sells out very quickly with Svengoolie. Mm-hmm. That kind of...
He seems to be making Northwest Indiana a destination.
He does. He absolutely does. And this fits in right with this whole Svengoolie mantra, the culty, cheesy horror genre.
Totally.
After Toxic Avenger then goes into our Christmas season. This year we're doing two productions. We're doing a naughty and nice back-to-back type of shows. The first one is The Santaland Diaries. Mm-hmm. That's our naughty version. That's written by David Sedaris, comedian. It's essentially an out-of-work elf. It's a one-man play. Right. And for those who saw it several years ago, it's the same actor doing the same. We're kind of reprising
and
that.
You liked him. He
wild
was
success.
Oh, that's great.
And he's going to be doing it again.
All right, we only have a couple seconds left. So what's the other
next
one?
Next one.
What's the nice one?
Best Christmas Pageant Ever, based on the 1980s children's book, wildly popular then. And we're going to bring that back here and make that our family and nice production.
Nice. That is nice.
That is nice.
Good.
Very nice.
Well, I'm sure we'll have you back in the future, Jason, to tell us about more shows.
Wonderful.
At Chicago Street Theater. Thanks for being here, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear Eye on the Arts on Mondays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcast of all the Eye on the Arts conversations can be found right now that we have up, including this one, at lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Lorelei Weimer from Indiana Dunes Tourism about a rather innovative way to help bring visitors to the lakefront.